here and start off with public hearings on House Bill 2867 and 2847, and then 2787, and then 112 and 3324. So let me open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2867. Dave Beck, our expert on school finances here.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2867 modifies a requirement for a high school to qualify as a small high school for the purpose of state school fund distribution. It applies to the first applies to 1920 distribution and takes effect July 1, 2019. With dash two, the cap on school district ADMW is 9,500. It's a change from the intro version at 10,500.
That kind of came to
an abrupt ending day, I'm sorry. Rep. Rushke, Warner Rushke is here. This is his bill, and maybe you could explain the predicament your school is in.
Sure. Thank you very much, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Benz, and member of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is E. Warner Rushke, and I'm fortunate to be the state representative for House District 56, and I represent the fine people and ideas of Southern Klamath and Lake Counties. Today, I bring forward to you House Bill 2867 for your consideration. This is one of my favorite type of bills because it makes a small and very narrow change, but will have an important impact on the lives of students. In short, House Bill 2867 changes one number and one number only in statute, and that is from 8,500 students in a school district to 10,500, or with the dash two amendments that are being considered, 9,500. So from 8,500 to either 95 or 10,500. This number is important because it's the ceiling for the number of students that may be in any one school district in order for a small high school to receive additional funding. Currently, the small high school funding is around $2.5 million and is allocated by the number of students in the program. The change made in House Bill 2867 from 8,500 to the number to be determined by you does not ask for additional funds. By increasing a number, it does not add any new additional districts, and by increasing the number, it does not add any new high schools. What House Bill 2867 does do is it allows Klamath County School District to slowly grow in total population without jeopardizing or negatively impacting all the small high schools that will receive funding and wish to continue receiving this funding. When this bill was before the House Committee on Education, there were several students from Klamath County School District who traveled 200 plus miles one way, and yes, over a snowy pass to testify further about this bill. They were accompanied by several from the Klamath County School Board and the superintendent of Klamath County School District, who is also here today. I'm more than happy to provide you a video link of their testimony. It was quite endearing. If you want to hear directly about why they need this funding in these rural schools. This bill is bipartisan in support, passed unanimously out of the House Education Committee, passed unanimously out of the House Revenue Committee, and also unanimously on the House floor. I thank you for your consideration in helping a rural county maintain its educational financing for the smallest of high schools, and I encourage your aye vote.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for Representative Warner Rushke? Thank you for bringing. I'm sorry, Senator Bocas.
First, a question to staff, and then comment from the representative, if you would indulge me, Mr. Chair. Dave, can you tell me how many high schools at 8,500, how many at 9,500, and how many at 10,500?
All right. So let's focus on the school districts that have small high schools. Okay. So Klamath County School District is reaching 8,500. At this point, is it about 8,300? The next in line is Lincoln City, okay. Lincoln County, excuse me. It's about at 7,000 ADMW. Okay. And then way behind, it's Morrow County at about 30,000 ADNW. And the other provisions are intact. They don't change.
Right.
And so small high school, I mean, high school should have, well, should have been a small high school since 1969. Mm-hmm. There's no expansion
right.
at the definition or addition, or you can only lose, but we cannot, we will not add any high schools, small high schools, because of other provisions. Mm-hmm. So, and then about the additional weights that Klamath County School District expects. But at this point, there's no change. I mean, it's still below the cap for 1921. Is they're going to continue to get about 2 million extra mm-hmm. based on about 280 mm-hmm. ADM. There are four high schools in Klamath County that qualify as small high school.
So then, in short, the difference between 8,500, 9,500, and 10,005, go 10,005 back to 9,500, short of the discovery of gold or oil wells in Klamath County, it's not going to have an immediate impact. It's actually going to address the intent of the bill, right?
That is looking forward.
Right, right. But do you have gold claims or oil claims you're thinking are down there, Representative? Or?
Declare a conflict of interest. Chair Haas and Senator Boquist, looking at the other end of your question, the nearest high school close to Klamath County is the district is Springfield, which is around 13,000. So you have 8,300 and 13,000. We're just trying to find a good number in there that allows Klamath County to grow, but doesn't, again, bring in more high schools.
I'm fine with 95 or 10,500. I was just trying to see, are we trying to weed somebody out? Did somebody not make the cut of playoffs and we didn't want to do so? I was just trying to figure out what was transpiring here. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing this forward. I think we want to do something to help. We, you know, it's hard for some of us. In Beaverton, we yeah. have, I think, three high schools with more than 2,000 students in each one,
yeah.
and two others with more than 1,500. And so everybody has different problems in schools.
I'm familiar with Beaverton High School. I mean, the school district, because that's where I graduated from, was Sunset High School. And that time we had 1,500 in that school. So very familiar with Beaverton, Aloha, and Sunset.
My goodness.
Go Apollos.
Sunset. You were an Apollo?
I'm an Apollo, yes. Yes, oh. sir.
That changes everything.
That good or bad?
I'm
just trying to check out here.
Yeah. So, but then you know, I mean, Sunset has its issues, just like Klamath has its issues.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, sir. We do have some people signed up to testify. Morgan Allen, Lori Wimmer, and Lori Satsfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morgan Allen here on behalf of COSA, but we've also submitted written testimony on behalf of the Alphabet Soup of K-12 lobby organizations, Stanford Children, OSEA, OEA, and OSB, in support of the bill with the -2 amendment. And we'll be very brief, and then we can answer any questions you may have. I think one of the things we did want to put on the record, Mr. Chair, is we do appreciate that you are very thoughtful when we have conversations about changing the state school funding formula, because it does create winners and losers sometimes, and people sometimes bring legislation to advantage particular school districts or communities. But we also think there are times when you can look at the formula and make individual case-by-case decisions, and in this case, we believe that changing the cap is appropriate because it does not disadvantage or harm students in other school districts. And as was mentioned, the formula does have a small high school correction that provides extra resources to mostly rural high schools. About 100 school districts actually get this correction for their high schools. Klamath County is the largest one. They are approaching the 8,500 ADMW cap. That's weighted students, even though they only have about 6,500 students in Klamath County. Very high poverty, lots of students with disabilities, which is one of the reasons they're approaching the cap. The district is very unique. Even though it's the largest district that receives the small high school correction, they do have four small rural high schools. in the district, and the district is larger than many states. It's bigger than Delaware. It's over 6,000 square miles, and the schools range from 13 students to about 700 students of their 23 schools. So we do want to mention that the four high schools, just to get those on the record, it's Bonanza, Chiloquin, Gilchrist, and Lost River High Schools. And about 40% of the staffing costs for those four high schools are paid for by this grant, which is about $2.4 million per school year. So we do appreciate the conversation about the formula. We do support the Dash 2 amendment, a compromise of $9,500. And I would just put on the record that the loss of these resources for the school district could not be replaced. It's about 3% of their general fund. So in a district like Beaverton, that would be the equivalent of getting hit probably $18 to $20 million. Would be my rough estimate. If the money were to go away, it would be de minimis to most school districts. Our largest school district, Portland, would pick up, you know, maybe another $3 per ADMW, so another $150,000 a year, compared to the impact that this has on the students in Klamath County. So we appreciate the conversation. We appreciate the chair and the committee's thoughtful approach to changing the state school fund, and we just wanted to offer our support, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Or the lifelines. Mr. Chair, committee members, for your record, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association. And I think Morgan said all that we really need to say. We don't need to take a lot of committee time, except I did want to point out that we do have 30 teaching jobs at stake, which is something that got our attention in this one.
Lori Satin spoke for the Oregon School Boards. I have nothing to add. I'm just the lifeline.
Thank you for testifying. I guess I should mention that when you have chastised me when I have come at the formula for various things and the alphabets, as you put them, mm-hmm. have said, no, you can't mess with the formula like this. Yet here we are, and even though this is a relatively small increase, every other school district will be paying for this because it's inside the formula.
Mr. Chair, I totally acknowledge that point, and I think that Mr. Allen said it well when he said, in general terms, the lens with which we look at all of those proposals is, how is a greater good and greater impact achieved? Is it achieved through formula changes? Is it achieved through something like that magnificent Student Success Act you just passed? Is it achieved through some other fix in some other way, or is it a formula change? Very infrequently, it has anything to do with the formula. This would be one exception.
Okay, any questions of this panel?
All right, thank you.
We're gonna close public hearing and work session and come back to that. And I'll open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2487. Kyle, hospitals.
Nonprofit hospitals, nonetheless.
Yeah.
Hey, look, am I a no vote on this one there, Senator?
I wouldn't think so.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I think it was 2847.
Exactly.
Is the,
did I say 2487?
It was 2487, is what you said. Just want to make sure you do 2847.
If I did say we were opening up a work session, public hearing on 2847.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2847 is a measure that's making a change to an existing tax credit that we have. This is the Rural Medical Provider Income Tax Credit. So just a very brief refresher on this one. Again, this is a tax credit that's on the books today, and it ranges in $3,000 to $4,000 or $5,000. For the rural medical provider, dependent upon the area that the provider is practicing and its distance from an urban area. So the change in House Bill 2847, and this information is contained in the revenue impact statement as well, is it's making a modification to where a staff could be located, or it's basically adding one hospital to the list at which staff can be located that can qualify for this credit. And the hospital in question here would be adding Sky Lakes Medical Center in Klamath Falls. So again, in the revenue impact statement, this is, as it's adding one more hospital that can qualify or being a qualifying area, we're expecting about $200,000 expansion in the tax credit per year.
Questions of Kyle?
instead of buffers?
I'll pass at the moment.
I could sense a question brewing. Okay.
No, I mean, this is yeah. Didn't notice this one.
Okay.
Rep Warner Reschke.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, and Vice Chair Benz and committee members. For the record, again, my name is E. Warner Reschke. I'm State Representative for House District 56, encompassing Southern Klamath and Lake Counties. This bill, House Bill 2847, expands the list of tax credit for rural medical providers by one and only one hospital, Sky Lakes Medical Center, located in my district in Klamath Falls. You all probably have a much longer memory than I do on this rural tax credit, but my understanding is the original idea was to help rural hospitals recruit and retain high-quality medical talent. Rural hospitals often can't match the salaries and compensation packages often offered by urban hospitals, nor can they offer the other amenities that a medical provider and their families are looking for, like the shopping, dining, and entertainment amenities that you can get in urban areas. Therefore, this tax credit was created to create a level playing field, or in 2019 parlance, I'll use to help create greater equity between rural and urban hospital recruitment. House Bill 2847 makes a small and narrow change in how hospitals qualify in order to allow medical providers for Sky Lakes Medical Center, a hospital in my district, to take advantage of the Rural Oregon Medical Provider Tax Credit. The Oregon Office of Rural Health has identified about 40 medical providers that do not currently qualify their tax credit who would then be eligible. The revenue impact, as described by Kyle there, is about $200,000 per year if all providers take advantage of the credit. Now, I'm confident when we talk about rural, this is a great descriptor for House District 56, which is predominantly populated by farmers, ranchers, fields, and forests, and therefore what was intended by the original bill that offered tax credits to rural Oregon medical providers. This bill passed with full support out of the House Committee on Revenue and unanimously on the House floor. Again, I thank you for your consideration for this and to help us and Klamath retain and recruit high-quality medical talent by ever so slightly expanding this rural provider medical tax credit by one. Thank you.
Thank you.
Quick question, Senator Bell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess the obvious question is you have been successful in recruiting there, or you wouldn't have those who are currently eligible for this should it pass. What's the need for it at this point? By the way, I supported this for years because of the importance of it over my area, and it's been there for a long time and is extraordinarily valuable in my area. I do recall, I don't know how many conversations about this bill over the years, so I'll just put it to you as squarely as I can. Why do we need it now in your area when you've been able to get people there without it?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Haas, Senator Benz, great question. First of all, I'll just say that Klamath, the Sky Lakes, is at a disadvantage to all other rural hospitals in Oregon without this tax credit. So even though we've been successful at recruiting talent, and talent is there, whenever a new medical provider is considering what area to move to, they can get a tax credit in Coos Bay, they can get a tax credit in your area, they cannot get a tax credit at Klamath County. So this is just to kind of level the playing field as far as all rural hospitals being able to play in this this bathtub, as you will.
Sure. And can you explain to us, you did when you visited my office a day or so ago, why you're not currently included, but I'm afraid it slipped my memory already.
Chair Haas, Senator Benz. The reason is the way the hospital was designated before by federal statute, the way it's designated and was excluded when the rural hospital tax credit was put in place in Oregon. Now, why that is, I don't know. All this bill does is change and allows that designation to be included. Again, it only includes, by making that change, it does not bring in any other hospitals in Oregon, just Klamath County, Sky Lakes Medical Center.
Okay. Kyle, refresh my memory, because you have been beaten to death on this particular issue. Didn't we means test this? We capped and means test this too, isn't that correct? And yeah. What is the means testing now?
Yeah, Senator Boquist, I'm just checking my notes to even get the date on when we did that. But yes, there was added a means testing of, double check, I believe it's 300,000 AGI.
Right.
Or below. There are certain exceptions to, like, general surgeons and such as well that go beyond that.
And did we not remove passive income from that? Just refresh the committee's memory. And for the newbie here, I mean, we had doctors around the rural area making $1 million on, you know, their investments, swinging their golf clubs all day, and then just volunteering enough to get $10,000 medical tax credits. And then we had two problem counties. You're one of them. So means tested it, and yes. The rest of it. I mean, any other, what are the other parameters to ensure that it's not, we still have, is there a passive income allowed in this, or is it active mm-hmm. income only?
Senator Boquist, looking at the statute, is just pointing, saying has adjusted gross income not in excess of $300,000 for the tax year, so that would mm-hmm. capture all that other mm-hmm. types of income as well, not just $300,000 directly from the hospital right. or their practice, yes.
And if I recall correctly, we had this argument before. Medicare, of course, covers Medicare. It doesn't cover TRICARE, correct? I don't think TRICARE is in the bill either.
Senator Boquist, I'd have to double check to make sure the statute on there, because it does have the Medicare, and then it has receiving medical assistance. But I could double check on the rules to see.
Okay, for TRICARE.
Yeah.
Philosophically, I'm sort of fine. It's just that we had a lot of problem with this particular.
Ask and Senator Boquist, if I may, Oliver Droppers is here from LPRO, from the Healthcare Committee, who helped me craft this bill. And if you want,
you want to come on up?
If he's allowed to come up, he might be able to answer some of those questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Oliver Droppers, Legislative Policy and Research and Office. Senator Boquist, your question, TRICARE is not included in the calculation or determination for the hospital relevant to being determined for the rural tax credits, no.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming up. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. My takeaway from that debate is Senator Boquist saying philosophically he's just fine.
Hey, there's three of you, and I have to go to another hearing, so you're good to go, Mr. Chair.
Close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2847. And I'm going to open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 112. We have a long agenda here today, but we will be closing down at 1:50 just to make sure everybody understands our time constraint. So this will be a bill that will be amended. And Mazen is here to talk about the amendment.
Chair has members of the committee. The amendment, as we have it, is a dash one, and was able to quickly put an SMS on it. The idea, I guess, of the amendment, it guts the whole bill, so none of the base bill is relevant anymore. But what it does, it deals with the issue of the tax, what we call the ton tax. The ton tax is the tax that is paid on agricultural products used in making wine or cider for that matter. So it's either grapes or apples or so on. And it allows for the payments to be made on the grapes that are exported. Well, today it's half that amount, so $25 per ton. And the exported grapes are 12.5. And then I think there is a mechanism of how that would be paid from either the ton tax producer or the ton or grape producer. versus the winery. And the amendment, I think, allows for the mechanism for the winery that either delivers directly into Oregon to pay for the other half of the $25, which is 12.5, or if it's not, then the ton tax the grape ton grapes producer will be the one that still pays the tax. That's the way I understand it.
Dan German, Jane McKinney, and Kevin Chambers.
Chair Hess, members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman here today representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. Thank you very much for hearing Senate Bill 112 today. Again, as staff said, we're going to be speaking to an amendment that will replace the entire bill. I believe that amendment is on OLIS now in the Dash 1 amendments. The amendment is very simple. The intent of the amendment is very simple, and that is to require out-of-state wineries that are using Oregon grapes for their winemaking processes to pay the same tonnage tax that applies today to Oregon wineries. It's a very simple premise. As our industry has evolved over the years, more and more entities are selling their grapes out of state. There's a good market for that. We estimate about 20% of those grapes are leaving the state, but there's no mechanism in place in our 36-year tonnage tax law to require out-of-state wineries that are using those grapes for winemaking to pay that tax. So as staff indicated a moment ago, the tax is $25 per ton on all grapes that are grown for winemaking in the state of Oregon. That Oregon winery is required to pay that tax to the OLCC, and the mechanism in the law today is that that winery and the grape grower who sells the grapes to the winery can split that tax, $12.50 each. Now, in some cases, the winery actually will just absorb that $12.50 on behalf of the grower, but that's at the discretion of the winery. So, but the law indicates that $12.50 is matched between the winery and the grape grower. That exists today for an Oregon winery. That Oregon winery, as a licensee of the OLCC, remits that $25 per ton to the agency, and that's the money that funds the Oregon Wine Board. Right now, there is no requirement in the law that an out-of-state winery that is buying grapes must pay their portion of the tonnage tax. So the intent of this amendment is to make clear that that would happen in the law. And why that's so important is that this is the major funding source for the Oregon Wine Board. In a moment, I'll introduce Jana McKamey with the Oregon Wine Growers Association and Kevin Chambers, who's a member of the Oregon Wine Growers Association Board and a member of the Oregon Wine Board. He's a grape grower in the Amity area and can talk about the efforts of the Wine Board. But the Wine Board is the entity in the state. It's appointed, the members are appointed by the governor. It's a semi-independent state agency that does all the marketing, promotion, research, education functions on behalf of the Oregon industry. Oregon has a 1% market share nationwide for wines. Other states like California have 90%. The effort is daunting to try to build up a brand Oregon to have our grapes compete on a national and international level, and that's the very important work of the Oregon Wine Board. So again, with this legislation, with this Dash 1 amendment, we are hoping that you will move it this session. It was part of a larger bill that had a little controversy to it, but this was the one piece of that larger bill that really didn't have controversy to it. So we appreciate you, Senator Hass, and your willingness to take this one piece of that bill and move it into Senate Bill 112. Happy to turn it over to Jana and Kevin if they want to answer any questions from the committee. I've got a testimony submitted on OLIS that talks about the provisions in their Dash 1 amendments, and look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, my name is Jana McKamey, and I'm the Vice President of Government Affairs and Operations for the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I only wanted to add to Dan Jarman's testimony that with that 20% of the wine grapes that are being sold out of state, that would equate to about $450,000 additional dollars going to the Oregon Wine Board to fund critical brand building and research initiatives. And that is about 25% of the Oregon Wine Board's budget from 2017. So it's a very significant growing amount. And this 20% sales out of state, that represents a 60% increase over the prior year. So this doesn't isn't intended to discourage those sales. Those are important sales outlets for our growers, but it puts the wineries on a level playing field, whether they're in the state of Oregon or outside of the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Senator Haas, Chair Haas, and the committee, my name is Kevin Chambers. As already stated, I am a grower located outside of Amity. I'm in my fourth term serving on either the Oregon Wine Board or the predecessor Oregon Wine Advisory Board. I've been appointed to this role by three governors. I take this issue very seriously. Quite frankly, this has been a topic of discussion in our industry for a couple of decades. It only recently has become one of great significance to us because it's the first time large amounts of fruit are leaving the state of Oregon and being produced out of state. We appreciate the demand for Oregon fruit out of state. As an independent grower, it's a very important outlet for me and others. So in no way, shape, or form do we want to diminish that demand. But we do need to have tax fairness. This amounts to an economic advantage to an out-of-state producer. In many cases, these are actually being produced for retailers or distributors who obviously aren't paying the tax. It's only the winery that is paying the tax. So this is a growing issue for us. It's a growing leakage in our tax receipts, and it's important to the long-term health of the Oregon wine industry.
Thank you. Senator Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't have a clue about this area, so forgive me. But the $450,000, did I hear that that is roughly 25% of the total fruit grown in Oregon is exported? Is that what you just said in general?
Yes, thank you for the question, Chair Haas, Senator Benz. The 20% is being sold out of state, and if the 1250 tax were being paid on that, we equate that to about $450,000 that would additionally go to the Oregon Wine Board's budget, and that is actually 25% of the budget. So 20% is going out of state, and that represents a 25% of the Oregon Wine Board's annual budget.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Benz.
When the fruit leaves the state, is the underlying assumption that it's enjoying or being marketed as Oregon grapes, or are there situations where that's not the case?
The Oregon, thank you for the question, Senator Benz and Chair Haas. The issue is that Oregon Pinot Noir has become a globally identified brand, and as such, it's to the advantage of a producer to use Oregon Pinot Noir on the label. So I do not know of a situation where something is just being branded as Pinot Noir. Places matters in the wine business globally, and it would be Oregon grapes are generally not as inexpensive as those from some other regions, so it would not be logical for a winery to buy Oregon fruit and not identify it as such in the present marketplace.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Okay, so all I heard were I didn't hear any assertions of fact in what you just said. What you said was, we guess that this is the case. Right? Can you give me something a little more firm than that?
The problem would be, sir, is if we were going to just say, well, the fruit goes out of state and doesn't return or doesn't get marketed as an Oregon-branded product, the only way we're going to know that is if we engaged in an audit of every certificate of label approval going to the TTB, and frankly, I don't see that we have the funds to do that.
Senator Benz and Chair Haas, maybe I can also touch on one other thing. It's important to note, too, that the Oregon Wine Board uses some of its resources to fund research that's very critical to the industry and to grape growers in the state. And that research is helping strengthen our grape growing industry, things that are happening in the vineyards, and all buyers of Oregon grapes, whether you're in this state or outside of the state, will benefit by a very strong grape growing industry, the one that Mr. Chambers is involved with. So it's not just about the marketing and promotion of Oregon wines, it's about these other critical areas for our wine industry.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So the question that I think I may have asked earlier today was what impact, if any, would there be on those who are currently exporting grapes from Oregon by virtue of this law? Do we have a feel for it's been suggested that this is a very modest impact, this because the price of a ton of grapes was variable, but that this would be a very modest amount and folks wouldn't really mind as they're busy buying grapes if this was tacked on. Is that a correct statement? And if so, what do we have to prove that they don't care that we would impose this cost upon them, those who are now exporting grapes? So explain to me, somebody say to me on the record that this is such a modest number that it won't impact the ability of those who are currently raising food in Oregon to export it without harm to their market.
Thank you for the question, Chair Haas, Senator Bentz. We wouldn't be able to surmise what the response of what out-of-state buyers would be. What I can say is this $12.50 a ton represents less than 1% of the cost of a ton of grapes. And it's currently what an Oregon producer is having to pay. And so really, again, it's leveling the playing field. But I could not give you a definitive answer on your first assertion.
Yeah, and Senator Bentz, as we spoke this morning, I don't have the numbers in front of me. They're hard numbers in the Oregon Wine Census report. The latest report was 2017. And the number that I remember was something that I shared with one of your Senate colleagues who from the Rogue Valley area. And the average price a ton in 2017 was $1,655. So that's less than 1% of an assessment. Again, in our conversations with those in the industry in the state of Oregon, we have not heard anyone say that they have problems with this tax. I think they understand what the intent is to support our Oregon industry, promotions, research, all of those things. And for a tax that is less than 1%, we have not heard a outcry of concern from those in our industry.
Saying that all of the purchasing wineries or exports out of state are not paying this, or is it a case where some are and some aren't?
Chair Haas, thank you for the question. There are some that are paying to the OLCC, but it's currently not a requirement for them to do so.
Yeah, and Senator Haas, we did have conversations with the OLCC about this. We started these conversations about 2 years ago with the OLCC. I mean, Kevin says the industry's been talking about it for 20 years, but we started talking about a specific legislative idea 2 years ago. And one of the challenges is that some of these out-of-state wineries, they're not able to track this because the OLCC hasn't had the enforcement tools to be able to do that. And what I mean by that is that you need to have some sort of relationship with the state for you to be able to, for the OLCC to get that tax from you and audit that tax. And so, as you see in this legislation, we require those that have certain kinds of permits to now pay this tax. That is the mechanism now that the OLCC can compel them to pay the tax and have some sort of auditing capability, which did not exist before. So the long answer is it's been hard to know those exact numbers, and the OLCC doesn't know it. So we just have to go on census data of how much we think is leaving the state and what is being collected.
And just one last point of clarification, that this is producing wine that in most cases is selling for well in excess of $120. That's the producer's recovery, $120 a case. That's 2.38 gallons. A ton of grapes will yield approximately 160 gallons. So we're talking about literally pennies per bottle here in this physical cost.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 3 of the dash ones, there's in section 3, line 22, it reads, a purchase of vinifera, I don't know if that's pronounced correctly, or hybrid grapes harvested in the state is exempt. You have to tell me what that is and why the exemption.
Thank you for the question, Chair Haas, Senator Bentz. That is specifically relating to American viticultural areas that are in two states. So between Oregon and Washington, there are a number of wine growing regions that are shared. So we have the political boundaries and then the geographical boundaries. And if the producer is on the Washington side, but it's inside of one of these shared areas, they are already remitting tax on that production to the Washington State Wine Commission. And so if they were to also have to pay the same tax to Oregon, if they're not labeling it as Oregon, they would get double taxed on that. So this is to create a situation to avoid double taxation in those wine regions that span two states.
I hope my
is it up
question.
In the Columbia River area?
Yeah, so the Walla Walla Valley, the Columbia River Gorge area, yes.
And the Snake River as well, that's with true. Idaho yes. as well.
I think I heard you say that it's likely no one would object to this. Did I hear you say that, that those who are exporting grapes into California that currently are not paying are going to be, what are they going to, if we pass this, are they going to be happy finally doing their duty for paying when they haven't been? Are they going to lose market? Or what are they going to? I got the impression they were okay with this. Is that a correct statement?
Sure. Sure. Senator Benz, I would think that we would hope that with the wine board having additional resources to continue to market and promote the industry, promote brand Oregon, and make that brand more recognizable, more saleable nationwide, worldwide, that they would benefit by that. We would hope that that's the case. Can I say that there's absolutely no opposition to this? I can't say that. But as we've been talking about the broader legislation that has been discussed at this legislature, the one piece of that, this tonnage tax piece, is the one that the folks who've been involved have said they really haven't had any issues with. And that's one of the reasons we asked Senator Haas and others to proceed just on this piece of legislation.
Chair Haas and Senator Benz, I would tell you that as a libertarian grape grower, I just assume pay no tax to anybody. But I think in the respect of fairness to all, this is an appropriate ask.
Funny how taxes work that way sometimes.
Funny how that works.
We're familiar with the dynamic. Senator Riley, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you. So let me understand. The $25 is shared between the grower and the wine producer. Is that correct? And the ones that are shipped to California, are the growers paying their half?
The problem we have with that, Senator Riley, is we don't have any agency that tracks who the growers are. So there are many growers, quite frankly, who could be shipping in. I will say are, however, I'm not going to sit here and prepare evidence for you, call out names, but we have no mechanism to track growers in this state. We don't require a license or a permit to grow grapes, and so we don't really know who all the growers are. We do know that many of them are choosing to pay their portion of the tax, but if we don't know who they are, my general experience is they would probably choose not to send $12.50 to the government.
Chair Haas, Senator Riley, on the Oregon Liquor Control Commission's form to pay the tonnage tax, on the far right, there is a column for growers to remit their $12.50 and submit that to the OLCC. But again, the OLCC doesn't have a natural nexus to the growers the same way they do with wineries who have to be licensed.
See, alcohol is, of course, a highly regulated substance. There are agencies that track that. Nobody is tracking fruit production. It's not highly regulated.
Maybe Senator Riley and Chair Haas, the last thing I'd say is this, as you saw, the implementation date for this bill is July 1, 2021. Part of the reason it was put out is that we want to continue conversations within our industry and with OLCC about, you know, how we're going to enforce this. The bill allows for rulemaking authority to the OLCC, as they currently have, to enforce the tax. So there'll be some ongoing conversations about the most efficient way to do that.
So what I'm hearing is, and I think I heard you say, some of the growers are paying this, but the winemakers that they're selling to may or may not be. Is that?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all. We're not ready to pass this out due to just paperwork. So I will close work session. and public hearing on Senate Bill 112. Stand at ease for a second. If you'll excuse me, I'm going to turn this over to Senator Benz, and he can open up the hearing work session on Senate Bill 2787. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, you're coming back. You're going to be back for a half hour. So you simply want a public hearing on the wet marine insurance bill, and then we're done. Is that pretty much what you're calling?
Okay.
Let's do it.
Sure. Okay, we are opening a public hearing on House Bill 2787.
Senator Benz, members of the committee, House Bill 2787 changes the tax on wet marine and transportation insurance provided by unauthorized insurers from a tax on underwriting profit to a tax on their gross receipts with a rate of 0.75%. The bill seeks to distinguish between taxation schemes for these two different groups of insurers. There is a minimal revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
And we have Mr. Matt Marquis signed up to tell us about it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing Lloyd's of America today in support of House Bill 2787. This bill deals with wet marine and transportation insurance in the non-admitted market. Wet marine and transportation insurance, the easiest example of that I can give is really probably cargo. So things on a container ship, things on a train, things being hauled by truck. And when you get into the non-admitted market, they're usually higher risk, and that's why they are in the non-admitted market as opposed to the admitted market, which would be like the State Farm and Farmers of the world, if you will. There has always been a question around how or if this type of insurance is taxed in Oregon, and other states that tax this actually, of those that do tax it as a premium tax, as it was described earlier. There's been ongoing dialogue between DCBS and Lloyd's of America, which is a subsidiary, if you will, of Lloyd's of London, around trying to find a cost-effective way of collecting a tax on this type of insurance. Hence, you have the bill in front of you. This is a product of that those discussions. The bill switches the tax from a profit tax to a premium tax of 0.75, and frankly, it is a more cost-effective way for all businesses and allows DCBS a methodology of which to know who should be paying the tax and who should not be paying the tax. DCBS could not be here today. I know they sent the chair and vice chair an email earlier today expressing their apologies for not being here and that they were okay with the bill. It really is more of a technical issue, this bill, just how we're going to collect the tax and trying to raise the same dollar at the same time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I think we are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2787. And we're not going to move any of the bills today, so we're not going to vote on this one. No, I'm sorry. But these other folks will want to be able to have the opportunity to vote on this important bill. Therefore, anything further?
One more bill. Do you want to hear that? Or
which one is it?
3324. It's the electric vehicle charging. There are two people signed up to testify.
Are they? Okay, well then, let's... Did the chair want us to go forward with this? Okay, good. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3324A.
Chair Benz, members of the committee, this measure exempts funds collected through third-party vendors for payments received specifically for electric vehicle charging services from public gift laws. Apparently, the current transfer of funds is a violation of public gift laws, and so this is just exempting those payments from those laws. And there is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
And we have Amanda and Miles signed up.
Vice Chair Benson, members of the committee, Amanda Dalton, I'm here today on behalf of ChargePoint. We provide electric vehicle charging infrastructure. Staff did a pretty good job explaining kind of why we're here. This really came out of a work group convened by the state treasury over the summer. Participants of that work group, though, largely represented kind of finance, business industry, not necessarily technology industry or vendors currently doing business with the state of Oregon. this came out as a possible issue in terms of us collecting fees on our stations owned by the state or owned by a local government, kind of when we collect that fee from the consumer or the driver. Right now it's kind of going up into our account and then we remit back to the state. This holding is what's currently violating the public funds law. In our conversations with Rep. Nathanson on the House side, her comments to Treasury were to reconvene that work group over the interim and have a conversation about technology and future payment methods and how this law likely needs to be updated to reflect those new payment provisions. And so what this has done in the negotiated agreement with Treasury and Representative Nathanson on the House side was essentially granting us a 3-year exemption and so putting some pressure on Treasury and I think on the vendor side to come back to the table whether or not an outright exemption is the right path, but at least allowing us to continue to turn those stations back on so your local governments and state can continue to collect a small portion of those electric vehicle charging stations that are out there today.
Vice Chair Bence, members of the committee, for the record, Miles Pengilly testifying on behalf of Forth in support of House Bill 3324. Forth is a nonprofit trade association that advocates for the advancement of electric, hydrogen, smart, connected, and autonomous mobility. We have over 160 members representing auto manufacturers, electric vehicle charging companies, industry partners, local governments, nonprofits, and other stakeholders in the transportation electrification space. Forth sees House Bill 3324 as a technical fix bill, as Amanda was saying, that ensures that electric vehicle drivers have the same charging experience at any station across the vendor's national network, and also ensures that we have simple and secure payment processing for charging your electric vehicle. Electrifying our transportation sector is a crucial component in preparing for Oregon's transportation future, as well as meeting our state's climate goals. And House Bill 3324 is a small step that will help facilitate that transition. Thank you.
Questions for our panel? Once again, none. So I have one. So everybody's okay with this now? No one's stepped up with any objection to this approach to the problem?
Vice Chair Bence, we can't speak for everyone, but at least interested parties, I think we're there. Treasury did send an email to Chair Haas last night saying that they're comfortable with this step forward and that they're okay with the direction of the bill.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, so any more questions? Thank you very much.
You.
Nobody else has signed up? No. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3324. Now, is there anything else?
That's it.
Well, we're adjourned.